Hello, everyone, and welcome to JBFC Podcast, the official podcast of the Jacob Burns Film Center and Media Arts Lab. I'm your host, Andrew Jupin, and this week I'm sitting down with filmmaker Joe Berlinger discussing his new film, Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory. I was able to talk with Joe in an interview over the phone earlier this week, and I'm pretty much just going to play the entire thing for you. For those of you who don't know, the Paradise Lost films are about a murder trial that took place in West Memphis, Arkansas, starting back in the mid-90s, involving three teenage boys who were accused of murdering three younger boys. And the films deal with the investigation into the murders, the events surrounding the murders, the trial, and ultimately what we find to be the wrongful conviction of these three guys. They're all very powerful works of documentary filmmaking, and we were very lucky to have Joe in for the start of our Global Watch Film Festival this year to talk about the film and screen the film. I think it's an incredibly important film, not only because of the content of the film, but because it showcases the power of documentary filmmaking and just what we are capable of doing as filmmakers and storytellers. So I think that's all of an introduction you'll need. I had a great conversation with Joe. He was very open and game for answering all the questions I had for him. And it was a really great talk. So here now is me speaking with filmmaker Joe Berlinger. Okay, on the line now with me is Joe Berlinger, the filmmaker who brought us Brother's Keeper, Crude, and of course the Paradise Lost trilogy. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm good, although I'm sitting here in my house with no power and on a very crackly line, so I apologize for that.
No worries. This Halloween storm has been really crazy up here.
Yeah, and then after 5 days, I still have no power. We're roughing it up here in northern Westchester.
But we'll get through it.
Absolutely.
So, Joe, first of all, I think to get this out of the way, congratulations are definitely in order to you and Bruce for all the films have accomplished and all that they're going to continue to accomplish as time goes by.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it's as an artist, you know, whether you're a writer or a filmmaker, or journalist, whatever, you know, sometimes you are gripped with this feeling like, does my work have any relevance? Does it mean anything? And when you have a situation like this where the films have helped get people out of prison, it's very rewarding and very tangible. So that feels great. On the other hand, you know, I think the films are getting an awful lot of credit when, in fact, even though they were the catalyst for all that's gone on, you know, I think these guys got out of prison because of 10,000 acts of generosity and kindness from people all around the world. You know, this was a very unusual situation where the films really inspired this movement. And people, you know, really selflessly for two decades have been involved in trying to get these guys out of prison. And, you know, I don't want to act like I'm being falsely humble. Of course, I'm proud of the films, but, you know, I am a filmmaker. I get paid to make films. That's how I earn a living, is making films. And obviously I could make other kinds of films. But, you know, the people who aren't filmmakers, the people, you know, the regular people who kind of stepped out of their ordinary or their, you know, not ordinary, but people who stepped out of their whatever they do for a living to then selflessly help and raise money and raise awareness, you know, to me are the real heroes of this story. You know, for every Johnny Depp or Natalie Maines, you know, the kinds of Eddie Vedder, all of whom we deeply appreciate having gotten involved in this case, for every one of those big names, there are hundreds and hundreds of little names, unknown names, of people who just really cared about this case, and I think that's ultimately what made the difference.
Absolutely. Now, Joe, take us back just very briefly. How did you first come across the case of the West Memphis Three?
Well, one of the fascinating things about this entire journey is that we originally thought we were going down to make a film about guilty teenagers because we read a press clipping. Sheila Nevins, who's the head of documentaries at HBO and has been for a long time, sent us a little press clipping from the New York Times back in the day when you actually got press clippings, you know, as opposed to PDFs.
Right.
And so, you know, a press clipping was messengered to my office back in June of 93. And it was, you know, not a big story. It was, you know, basically, it seemed like an open and shut case of three guilty, rotten teenagers who had done some horrible act of devil worshiping and murdered these 3 8-year-old boys. And there was a confession, and they had just been arrested. And Sheila Nevins asked us to look into it. And we were fascinated by the case because a year and a half or so before that, I actually was trying to make a film about the Jamie Bulger case. This was a situation in the UK where a young kid about 10 years old had lured another kid out onto the railroad tracks, you know, in Liverpool, and kind of beat him senselessly to death. And so when we read this case, you know, in the Times, it seemed like another case of disaffected youth. Little did we know at the time just how one-sided the local press was, and this story that appeared in the New York Times was a condensed version that had made it to the AP wire service of a local newspaper article. And that was kind of, you know, the one-sidedness of the press is something that actually, the local press is something that actually, I believe, helped convict these guys. But at the time, again, around June 5th of 93, we read this article, thought, oh my God, you know, how could these kids have done something like this? Let's go down and investigate it, kind of like a real-life River's Edge. And thought, hey man, this could be an interesting film. I mean, so to be here 2 decades later, 3 films later, you know, having advocated for their innocence, you know, it just shows what a wild journey life and filmmaking can be.
Now, you mentioned just a second ago about the press having a lot to do with sort of, excuse me, being a part of the catalyst for this wrongful conviction. I was curious how you felt about where these boys happened to live and where this all went down in West Memphis. How much do you think any sort of religious fanaticism helped lead to the wrongful conviction? Yeah. With the talk of satanic panic and all of that?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to bust on religion or sound like I'm being critical of religion, but I do feel it fundamental Christianity did play a role in this, because this was a horrible crime, you know, the worst crime you can imagine, 3 8-year-olds, you know, being butchered to death. And in a part of the world where people literally believe in heaven and hell and the devils walk amongst us. And so only in that kind of environment. And also, I should say, you know, this is a part of the world and at a period of time where they, you know, these people implicitly, and this is not a bad quality, these people implicitly believed in authority figures, believed that the police would be telling them the truth, that the prosecution would be telling them the truth. And when the police and the prosecution put out this theory that this was a satanic ritual murder, coming off of a time also in our country in the late 80s, early 90s, there was this wave of satanic hysteria. You know, so in a fundamental Christian community where you believe the police and they're telling you that this was a satanic ritual killing, that was very scary to people and very believable. And so it explains how people could suspend their disbelief in the face of such a lack of clear, you know, evidence to link these guys to the crime. So I think it played a big role.
And along with that, too, a lot of the stuff they brought up during the prosecution's argument was, you know, all the stuff of the kids wearing black and the listening to Metallica and stuff like that. Do you think nowadays, with as a little more desensitized as we've become as a country, that sort of argument would hold as much water as it did to those people back then?
Yeah, no, I think this was, you know, Damien was goth before there was the label goth. You know, this was a rural religious community where, you know, this idea that heavy metal music leads you to, you know, to do evil things was a prevalent belief. I mean, you know, if this crime took place even back then, in New York or L.A., and these kids had been rounded up, you know, they'd be one of 10,000 kids. You know, but I think back then, because Damien dabbled in Wicca, which if you look into Wicca, is very, you know, it's a belief in nature. It's not devil worshiping. He listened, he and Jason Baldwin loved Metallica, but if you look at the Metallica lyrics, while they're anti-authoritarian, they certainly have nothing to do with devil worshiping. Of course, there are black metal, heavy metal groups that are satanic in nature, but Metallica is not one of them. So the fact that their lyrics were introduced into trial is kind of, you know, beyond absurd. Not only absurd, but it's also, you know, since when in this country, you know, can you be persecuted for either your religious beliefs, which is in Damien's case was Wicca, or your musical tastes? I mean, Stephen King novels were also introduced, you know.
So right.
It's kind of crazy.
When you and Bruce were down there in the 90s and up until these recent years, how was the attitude towards you by the citizens of West Memphis?
Well, you know, it was complicated. When we first went down there, for the most part, people were accepting of us because they didn't know what our point of view was. And I think each side assumed we would be telling the truth of the matter. And to each side, the truth was a very different situation. There were some, you know, early on we had people following us, and we had a couple of encounters where people were, you know, were asking us to get out of town, and it was a little scary at times. But for the most part, people accepted what we were doing, and in many ways, the camera was a catalyst for people to get things off their chest. By the time we made the second film, of course, when the first film came out, I think most people in Arkansas were horrified at the film because there was such a deep belief that these guys were guilty that I think people were, you know, very angry at us and felt that we had portrayed Arkansans as kind of rednecks, which to me is crazy. That's not at all what we were trying to do. We were trying to demonstrate that we thought the wrong guys were in prison. But over time, as people have lived with this story, as a younger generation has emerged, you know, kids who grew up with this story, who are now adults, there has been actually a huge change in sentiment in Arkansas, thanks in large part to an organization called Arkansas Take Action, which was a local grassroots organization that believed fervently in the innocence of these guys. And I think that a lot of that anger towards us, not from everybody, because there are still some people, including some of the victims' parents, who still believe the West Memphis Three are guilty. But for the most part, the general population has moved from, you know, really despising us after the first film came out to really being appreciating what we've done and coming to believe that these guys are innocent and got a raw deal. In fact, when these guys were released from prison on August 19th, and we were all down there to witness that and to film it, and in fact, that is part of what one will see in Paradise Lost 3, I was actually amazed at how many people, how many regular citizens came up to us, you know, patted us on the back, shook our hands, thanked us for doing what we were doing, saying that this has been a stain on Arkansas, and really appreciative. You know, 15 years before that, when Paradise Lost first came out, you know, those same people, many of those same people would have been spitting on us because they felt that these guys were guilty and that we had done, you know, a very lopsided, one-sided, you know, film that portrayed Arkansas in a bad light.
You mentioned a second ago about the camera and people seeing the camera and sort of making what they will out of, you know, what you were doing there. The entire trilogy is shot using the cinema verite style. And I was wondering if you could talk about the advantages of making a film like this in that way.
Well, you know, I definitely believe that, you know, the best way to be an advocate for a subject is to allow viewers to come to their own conclusion, which means using the cinema verite approach means you have to embrace both sides. You don't use narration to tell the viewer what to think. And ultimately, I think when you're sitting in an audience and you're hearing the pros and cons of a situation, You know, it is much more persuasive if you come to the conclusion yourself. You know, we want to treat the audience members like jury members, have them weigh the argument and come to the conclusion. You know, if you use narration, if you tell people what to think, it's a much more passive experience, and it's not as big an emotional revelation to yourself when you come to the conclusion that, hey, these guys seem like they're innocent or at the very least deserve a new trial. So I think the verite approach, you know, is well suited to this kind of a film. The downside, of course, is that some people walk away from your film not coming to the conclusion you hope that they come to. You know, the first Paradise Lost film especially, probably 20% of the people who watched the film said, hey, these guys look creepy, they seem weird, they must be guilty, which of course means they're buying into the same prejudice that the community did. But that's the price you pay for, you know, trying to have a balanced approach and trying to persuade people by letting them come to their own conclusion instead of kind of lecturing to them.
And when you're dealing with material like this, with the emotions as high as they are, how much of a challenge is it for you and Bruce to keep these people talking to you?
It depends on the situation. You know, after the second, I think the first film, I'm amazed at the access we were able to get. I mean, it was kind of the end of a certain era. I don't think Paradise Lost 1 could be made today. You know, the prosecution, the defense, the judge, all the families of the victims, all the families of the accused, all let us in. And I think it's because we made this film just before the 24-hour news cycle kicked in, just before court TV was catching on. You know, it's a different world now. If this crime had taken place today, you know, it would be covered, you know, live, gavel to gavel. There would be 80 satellite trucks from all the national media down there. There would be Hollywood agents running around buying up movie rights. And I think we happen to have caught this thing just before that big explosion. You know, so I think the first film, you know, really was a kind of, you know, special moment in time. And thank God, because if it wasn't for those films, I think Damien would be, or for that film in particular, Damien would be dead by now. You know, so the first film was relatively easy to get people to talk. The second film was really difficult to make because people did not, you know, trust us any longer in Arkansas. We weren't allowed to cover the appeal hearings. The cameras were banned from the courtroom. So, you know, and the third film was incredibly difficult to make because we decided that the third film should stand on its own, and should, you know, people should have if they've never seen one or two, the third film should be a self-sufficient experience. So telling an 18-year story and giving it that cinema verite vibe so that it feels like an unfolding narrative when in fact we no longer have a lot of access and a lot of the stuff happened in the past was very tricky. And I think the key to that was I kind of, in a flash, remembered that in my storage space where I keep lots of junk, I keep I'm just a pack rat. I remembered that I had all of this, you know, news coverage. You know, I collected everything, so I had all of the local news coverage right from the arrests on. And a lot of this stuff doesn't exist anymore, other than like the VHS tapes that I happen to have in my storage space. And we realized that, you know, using the local media as a narrative spine to tell the story, first of all, gives us a practical device for telling the unfolding narrative. But more importantly, it underscores this theme, because if you watch Paradise Lost from beginning to end and really analyze the press coverage that we use to tell the story, you see the very same reporters who grew up on this case still covering it. And there's a growing sophistication in their news coverage. It goes from being kind of very slanted towards treating these guys like they're probably guilty towards, in the mid-2000s, starting to treat them like, gee, maybe there's a problem here. And you see how the local media played a very big role in helping to get these guys convicted initially, and then playing another major role, you know, in more recent years in keeping the question of their convictions and the righteousness of their convictions, keeping that question in the press and starting to, you know, feel sympathetic towards these guys. It's an interesting journey that press coverage takes.
So now here we are, Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, all these years later. Did you ever think you'd be making a third film after you made Revelations?
Well, we actually did, because Paradise Lost 3 actually has been in production since 2004. It's just that long periods of time would go by where there was nothing to film. And the reason we kind of decided to continue telling the story is that we were just haunted by this case. I mean, I thought the first film was going to blow the doors off this case and get a result that ultimately was gotten, which was to build so much pressure that these guys would get out of prison. So I was surprised that the first film didn't do that. I was even more surprised that the second film didn't do that. The second film came out in 2000. And, you know, it just, we were always very disappointed that the case, look, especially the first film did everything a film could do in terms of the art of filmmaking. You know, it went to Sundance, it played on HBO, it got great reviews, it got tons of prizes. You know, all of that stuff was wonderful, but on the other hand, it never migrated off the entertainment page onto the editorial pages. You know, Entertainment Weekly was writing great reviews, but the New York Times editorial pages were not writing about this miscarriage of justice. And that always deeply bothered me. And as the years would go by, you know, with each passing phase in my life and each positive step forward, you know, whether it's personal or professional, I would just be haunted by the fact, as Bruce was, that these guys were just still rotting in prison. So the decision was made to start, you know, the third film in 2004, but it never really, you know, we didn't want to just put it out there until it felt like there was a reason and a time to put it out. And we, ironically, we were drawing Paradise Lost 3 to a close. In fact, it was locked, ready to, you know, we decided, because of the, as you see in the film, the Arkansas Supreme Court in September of 2010, for the first time in the history of this case, actually agreed with Echols on some key DNA evidence and awarded him an evidentiary hearing that was supposed to take place in December of 2011. And as soon as that decision came down, we realized this is our opportunity to finish the film and get it out there to try to help the case. And quite specifically, we wanted the film to air on HBO a couple of weeks before that December 2011 evidentiary hearing, because we wanted to put a spotlight on it, to let the world know that this was happening, to let the people in Arkansas know that people are watching. And so the great irony is that, you know, we had decided to finish the film. It had already been invited to, based on a rough cut, it had been invited to the Toronto and New York film festivals, in September and October of 2011, respectively, just a few weeks ago. And we were sitting in a room in around August 15th, putting the finishing touches of a locked, completed movie, you know, all the things you do in post-production, sound mixing, color correcting. We were in days of pressing the button and hitting eject on a finished movie when we got the call that these guys might be, getting out of prison. And so we rushed down, obviously delighted that this might be happening. And we were able to incorporate that into the film because it was already done, and so the timing is fascinating to me that we were finishing the film and now able to, you know, add this final chapter to that film, as opposed to, like, if we were still in production and this happened and this film came out a year from now, I don't think it would be as impactful. You know, mm-hmm. It's amazing how real life events, you know, impacted the end of this series.
You mentioned a while back the Arkansas Take Action Group, and in this film, I think one of the most powerful scenes of the entire piece is the protest that they hold at the Arkansas State Capitol. And yeah, it's this incredibly powerful shot of all these people lining up and showing all the support and all the postcards from all over the world that right. people were sending in for these guys. Talk about what it was like filming that day.
That was an amazing moment. That's when I realized for the first time, kind of emotionally, just how big this movement has become. And I suppose I should have realized it before, because not a week goes by where we don't get some request from somewhere for somebody who wants to play the DVD and they just want permission to play it for free and to have a little house party to raise money for the defense. And of course, we always agree to that. And wherever I go in the world, I run into people wearing Free the West Memphis 3 t-shirts. So on some level, I should have been aware that the movement was so big, but sitting on those state capitol steps with when they unfurled that collection of postcards from all around the world, I got very choked up because it made me realize just, you know, how powerful this thing has become. And I think that was the winds of change in Arkansas, you know, when the local population, that's why I think it was so critical that Arkansas Take Action did what it did, because only when local officials feel that there's danger for them, you know, because the local population is no longer buying into it, did that become motivating for them to find a conclusion, in my opinion. You know, of course, they'll tell you something else. I think there was a lot of, you know, concern about political fallout, and that's why a deal ultimately was negotiated.
One of the people that this film spends a good deal of time on is Terry Hobbs, and I'm curious to hear from you. What is your opinion of Terry Hobbs?
You know, I don't really like to give my personal opinion. I think the film treats him with, he becomes a person of interest to the people involved in the case, and mm-hmm. we felt an obligation to follow that story. People have often said, well, gee, the films are pointing a finger either at Byers or at Hobbs, and I don't agree that we're pointing a finger at anybody. I think we as journalists are covering the story of suspicion that other people have. And, you know, I think it was, you know, we have gotten some criticism from some of the more hardcore advocates of this case for having included in the movie the scene that demonstrates that DNA hair evidence actually isn't a slam dunk against Terry Hobbs. And I think it was very important to include that. You know, that hair could have been transferred to the crime scene via secondary transfer, which means, you know, a kid went to go play at Hobbs's house and then the hair was transferred in that manner. That the hair evidence in a court of law alone would be considered weak evidence, and that alone probably wouldn't convict the guy because it matches 1.5% of the population. And again, it could have been delivered to the crime scene via secondary transfer. The importance of these, of both the suspicion that was initially directed towards Byers and the suspicion that has been directed towards Hobbs, is not to say that these guys are the killers. Obviously, it can't be both of them.
Right.
I suppose in some bizarre scenario it could be, but we're not saying that. The point of including this is, A, that's what was going on in real life. You know, there was suspicion directed towards these guys. And B, more importantly for me, the importance, the utility of suspicion directed towards other people is that in this country, the measure of the law, the standard for putting somebody to death, is beyond all reasonable doubt. And when you have a case where there's such an abundance of doubt, where a better case could potentially be made against Byers or Hobbs than against the West Memphis Three, because there is zero evidence linking these guys to the crime, then for me, the utility is not to say, hey, those guys are the killers, because that's a very dangerous thing to do. That's exactly what happened to the West Memphis Three. You know, circumstantial evidence, and very weak circumstantial evidence in the case of the West Memphis Three, led to these guys being put in prison for 18 years. So we would never want to do that to another person. But from a legal standpoint, if a reasonable jury wouldn't be able to convict Eccles, Baldwin, and Miskelly because of an abundance of doubt, then these guys deserved a new trial, and they were on the path to a new trial. Of course, at the end of the day, the state realized that they could never win a new trial, and so they, you know, did this crazy Alford plea deal. So, you know, it's very important, you know, that people don't think that we are pointing a finger at anybody, because that would be wrong. You know, we are filmmakers, we're not lawyers. But their utility is that, look, there's a tremendous amount of doubt in this case, and if you're going to kill somebody on death row, you're not allowed to have any doubt. And a reasonable jury today would have found these guys, based on that hair evidence, based on some of the other things that have come out, would have found these guys not guilty, in my opinion. And obviously in the opinion of the state at this point, because if they thought that they could have won a new trial, they would have pursued it.
One of the people we were just talking about, also Mark Byers, has gone through quite a transformation in opinion over the years. And another incredibly powerful scene in the new film, I think, is after the deal is struck and he is talking with members of the media and just proclaiming about what a raw deal it was. It's another very powerful thing. Were you surprised at all by his transformation of opinion?
I was actually, very proud of Mark that he could admit that he had made a mistake. The guy went through hell, and the fact that he could stand up and be counted and demonstrate his support. I mean, he was very persuaded by that DNA evidence. Where I differ with Mark a little bit is I think he has been too quick to jump on the Terry Hobbs bandwagon.
Mm-hmm.
I find that a little troubling, although, look, I'm not the parent of a murder victim. I couldn't imagine going through that myself. I can't say how I would act, so I want to cut him all the slack in the world because, he went through hell for a long time. But I think, would be a little more judicious about pointing the finger when, in fact, he had the finger pointed at him for a very long time. But, his change of heart, him and Damien exchanging letters of apology, which to me in the film is, an incredibly moving moment, I found it very compelling.
Have you spoken with the three men? Do you keep up with them regularly? Is there email? Is there phone calls?
Yes and no. I mean, we had a wonderful time in New York. The New York Film Festival was an incredible experience. We had a packed house. I think it's like 1,100 or 1,200 seats at Alice Tully Hall were completely sold out. And at the end of the film, the tradition of the New York Film Festival is that the filmmakers sit in a box kind of above most of the audience in an upper mezzanine area. And when the film is over, they put a little spotlight on the directors. I mean, they do that for all the films that play at Alice Tully Hall at the New York Film Festival. And so we had the West Memphis Three join us, and there's a great picture of that floating around. But we had the West Memphis Three join us in that balcony for that little spotlight moment at the end of the film. And, I mean, we literally got a 10-minute rousing standing ovation.
That's amazing.
And obviously that ovation, I'd like to think a little of it was for the film, but it obviously that ovation was for those guys. And to be standing next to them, to see that the power of cinema can affect real life in such a tangible way and to share that moment with them was incredible, And while they were in New York, we spent some time with them. In particular, we spent time with Jason Baldwin, who to me is the real hero of the story because he really did not want to take the deal. And when he realized that he could save Damien Echols' life, he went against his principles and decided that, it wasn't right for him to risk that Echols could be put to death, and he took the deal. So to me, he is the unsung hero of this entire thing. Maybe not completely unsung, but to me, he is the hero. And so we spent quite a bit of time together. In fact, one of the more very New York moments that I will always cherish is, because of my previous film, Crude, I have a nice friendship with Sting and his wife Trudy Styler, and we were invited to the there was a Sting's 60th birthday party concert at the Beacon a week before the New York Film Festival. And so I asked all of them if they wanted to go, but only Jason took me up on the offer. So Jason and his new girlfriend came with us to see this concert, and Jason, as we were walking in, said that this is really his first rock and roll show, because the guy was an impoverished trailer park resident at the age of, plucked at the age of 16 and thrown in prison. And
yeah.
So he actually had never been to a rock concert. And so I just felt so great, you know, and it was just one of those classic New York moments that you just can't even describe, you know, because by the third song, you know, and this was Sting with a whole list of heavyweight guest performers like Bruce Springsteen and Lady Gaga and Will.i.am and Billy Joel, and by the third song, I just was thinking to myself, my God, this guy, this is his first rock and roll experience. He was in prison 6 weeks ago, and now he's at this this incredible concert. And then when the concert was over, we went to the after party, and you know, some very famous people, you know, all like when they realized who he was, all kind of made a beeline to him to embrace him and shake his hand and wish him well, and it was just a great moment. But in terms of staying in touch with everybody, well, first of all, Damien and his wife, Lori Davis, are in New Zealand for 2 months, so it's a little difficult to stay in touch. you know, I kind of feel like our job is done. You know, I don't want to, my door is always open to them, and, you know, and I'm sure we'll be in touch, but, you know, I don't want to overdo it. I don't want to mother them, nor do I want to make a film about what their life is like after prison, because to me that would be kind of taking advantage. I think we've been great stewards of the opportunity given to us to tell their story and to right or wrong. To continue to film them, to me, kind of feels like, unless we're going to definitively prove who the killer is, and that has eluded us for 18 years, unless we're going to definitively prove that as a tool for getting them fully exonerated by the state of Arkansas, because only ironclad proof of the killer is really going to get, you know, the only legal mechanism, I should say, because of this Alford plea arrangement, the only legal mechanism really to get them out of prison is for the governor of Arkansas to pardon them. And for that to happen, I mean, you would have to dump irrefutable, you know, ironclad evidence on his desk and say, you know, dude, sign the pardon. And I don't think that's going to happen, you know. And if I felt like I could definitively come up with that kind of hard evidence, which we haven't been able to do for the last 17 or 18 years, that to me would be the only reason to do a Paradise Lost 4, but to just follow these guys. And it just feels like it would be taking advantage of, you know, we had a mission accomplished. They're out of prison. To continue to film, to me, just doesn't feel right. It just feels like we're taking advantage of the situation.
Well, Joe, I would say mission accomplished indeed. We are playing Paradise Lost 3 to open our Global Watch Film Festival here at the Burns, and I cannot think of any better film to represent a film festival centered around human rights documentaries. I want to thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been really amazing talking to you, and again, congratulations to both you and Bruce and the West Memphis 3.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you having me on.
So that's it. That was my conversation with Joe. He's an incredibly talented filmmaker, along with his partner, Bruce Sanofsky. If you haven't seen these three films, most definitely get on it. The first two are available for rental and sometimes screen on HBO, so check your channel guide for that. The new film, I do believe, is debuting on HBO in January. Be on the lookout for that if you didn't get a chance to catch it at the Burns for opening night of Global Watch. It's an incredibly powerful film. It's very emotional. All things considered, it is as happy of an ending, I think, for right now as these three men could have imagined. So that's going to do it for this episode. If you'd like more information about this episode or any of the other episodes we've done here on JBFC Podcast, or if you would also like to find ways to get a hold of me, you can, of course, visit our website at www.podcast.burnsfilmcenter.org. And please, if you haven't yet, definitely subscribe to the show on iTunes. It's the easiest way to keep up with each episode we put out here on JBFC Podcast. It's completely free to subscribe to. And when you're there, if you'd like to write a review or just click a star rating, that would help us out a lot. It greatly increases the show's profile in the iTunes community and ultimately helps spread the word about what we're doing here at JBFC Podcast. As always, any other ticketing information, event information, education information, or volunteer information can be found on our website, www.burnsfilmcenter.org. And definitely check out Paradise Lost 3 Purgatory, as well as the first two films, Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills, and Paradise Lost 2, Revelations. Until next time, I'm Andrew Jupin, and this has been JBFC Podcast.